Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the MormonExpression.com podcast. My name is George and this is the inaugural podcast for me as the host and moderator of the topic. Our austere lead moderator, John, has offered to let me take the reins, but we are joined by Tom, one of our regulars on this podcast. Tom, do you want to say hi and wish me luck?
Hey, what's up, guys, and good luck, George.
Thank you much. This past summer at the Sunstone Symposium for 2009, I was fortunate to meet our guest, where she presented a paper entitled Church Evolution, a Comparison of the Black Priesthood in the Mormon Church and the Prospectus for Women. Melanie Cowley is an MFA student at Iowa State, earning a degree in creative writing and environment. Her environmental emphasis centers in religious studies. She's the current managing editor for Flyway, a journal of writing and environment, the campus literary journal. She earned her undergrad degree at Utah State, also in English, creative writing. She has been married 11 years and has two children. She joined the church as a convert when she was 15 years old. As part of her graduate work, she is writing a Mormon feminist novel detailing the story of four sisters who uncover the unpublicized truths of women's history in the church and the powerful change that transpires with their new reality. Melanie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, George.
It's great to have you on. Can you kind of give us a little bit of your background, both as an individual and also what your background in the church is a little bit?
Yes. I joined the church when I was 15. I was obviously not a member. I actually took a seminary class just to fill my schedule. I was taking a lot of same classes as a friend, and asked my parents if I could take LDS seminary, and they agreed. And in that class, I began reading the Book of Mormon. And I felt that I gained a testimony in the Book of Mormon after I had read it, and consequently decided to join the church. So I did that when I was 15, and I went to church with my friend up until I graduated from high school. And then I met my husband shortly after I graduated, just a couple months after I'd graduated, and was married in the temple about a year after graduating. Or actually, it was only about 6 months after graduating high school that we were married.
Where was this at? Where were you living at the time, Melanie?
Logan, Utah was where we were.
Oh, northern Utah. Okay, very good.
Yes.
So could you lead us through kind of a brief history of women's history in the LDS Church and where the progression of this has gone through?
Yeah. I actually have a timeline that I've put together. I borrowed the majority of this information from Linda King Newell's work, which is A Gift Given, A Gift Taken. And you can actually listen to this paper being presented on the MormonStories.org podcast. So I just wanted to reference her before I totally leaned on her for all this information. Women's spiritual authority in the church really started with Joseph Smith when he began the washing and anointing in the temple ceremony. Women were included and were authorized to bless each other. There's a couple quotes from Joseph Smith. When they asked him whether women should be allowed to give blessings, he said, "There could be no evil in it. If God gave his sanction by healing, there could be no more sin in any female laying hands on the sick than in wetting the face with water. And also, if the sister should have faith to heal, let all hold their tongues." Next major event that I think is probably worth mentioning is in 1857, Mary Ellen Kimball asks Mr. Heber C. Kimball if women had the right to wash and anoint the sick. The response was, inasmuch as they are obedient to their husbands, they have a right to administer in that way in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, but not by authority of the priesthood invested in them, for that authority is not given to women. He also said that they might administer by the authority given to their husbands inasmuch as they were obedient to their husbands. The next event would be on November 14, 1869. Brigham Young, speaking in a tabernacle, cited the example of a sick child and said, "Why do you not live so as to rebuke disease? It is your privilege to do so without sending for the elders." He ended by saying, "It is the privilege of a mother to have faith and to administer to her child. This she can do herself as well as sending for the elders to have the benefit of their faith." And then on August 1880, John Taylor's address on the order and duties of the priesthood, he states, reaffirmed that the women hold the priesthood only in connection with their husbands, they being one with their husbands. Then in 1888, President Woodruff sent a letter to Emmeline B. Wells, which made a distinction between washings and blessings as an ordinance, and hence confined to the temple under priesthood authority, and as a sisterly act. And then in 1901, an article appeared in the Deseret News, which stated, "Priest, teacher, or deacon may administer to the sick, and so may a member, male or female, but neither of them can seal the anointing and blessing, because the authority to do that is vested in the priesthood and after the order of Melchizedek." One of the editors to the Exponent, Louisa Lulu Green Richards, sent an angry letter in response to this article. And then at some point during the first decade of the new century, a two-page letter was released stating that administrations by women to the sick did not necessarily fall as Relief Society function, but it clearly indicated that the women did not need priesthood permission or participation in the performance of these duties. The letter also cautioned the women to avoid resemblances in language to the temple forms, and although the blessing should be sealed, the sisters did not need a priesthood holder to do it. Then the next date that I have actually jumps quite a bit further to 1946, which was July 29th. Joseph Fielding Smith wrote a letter to the Relief Society presidency, addressed to all three members. He was not the prophet at that time. I believe he was about to become prophet. And the letter stated, "While the authorities of the church have ruled that it is permissible under certain conditions and with the approval of the priesthood for sisters to wash and anoint other sisters, yet they feel that it is far better for us to follow the plan the Lord has given us and send for the elders of the church to come and administer to the sick and afflicted." And this letter basically was the death of all blessings sanctioned in the church by women. So this is the timeline that I have of women being allowed to exercise some sort of spiritual authority. I don't believe that there's strong evidence that women had a priesthood per se, but they definitely were allowed to exercise these spiritual gifts. So,
what year was that when they were officially stopped?
1946, and I think my grandma would probably remember when it was still allowed. So that's fairly recent.
So they didn't consider it a priesthood necessarily. Was that correct? Or was it like a smaller form?
There is a quote from Joseph Smith in the founding of the Relief Society where he promised the women that he would make priests out of them. But that was never in any way brought into any sort of realization. And from what I can see, from my perception, they were never told that they had the priesthood. But to me, it appears that there was more of a promise that that would come to pass, and then it just never manifested itself.
But it sounds like there was something that also changed subtly with the Wilford Woodruff timing. And I believe it was in the 1880s. What was that part of your timeline? Because it sounded like they were able to use it before that, and then he made a change.
Well, they were trying to. There was a couple of things that happened, and I was trying to cut down on all the information, and maybe I selected some of the wrong things. But Woodruff made a distinction from the temple ceremony, because what the washing and anointing that was happening in the temple was actually being performed also outside of the temple. basically the same language. And so he made a distinction between those two. There was also some question of whether only endowed women could give blessings. And there was actually, in 1909, Joseph F. Smith endorsed that letter to Emmeline B. Wells from 88, but then said that it could be any woman. They did not have to be endowed women. Anyone with faith could give a blessing.
When you said that, sorry, is it all right if I interrupt for a second?
Oh, yeah, please.
You say that they did washings and anointings outside the temple. Is that exclusively to, I think they were called the Endowment House? Was it exclusive to that, or did they actually do?
They would go to each other's home. And a lot of it revolved around childbirth. And they would go to another woman's home and bless her, typically, you know, while she was in labor. And they would perform that same washing and anointing that occurred in the temple.
Wow.
I believe that this is probably the reason why women were doing it, because in the old ceremony, they would touch, you know, the specific parts of the body as part of the ceremony. If you think back to initiatory, the way that used to be. And they would touch certain parts, the breast, so that they would produce milk and those sorts of things. So it was, you know, of course, it would be inappropriate in the Victorian times when this occurred for a man to do that. I think that might have been part of the reason why women were allowed to. But yeah, it was much different than what you would imagine.
Yeah, I'd never heard the initiatory work being done outside of the temple, especially in a childbirthing environment.
Well, I knew that they had, was it called an endowment house? Do you guys know?
I'm not aware of an endowment house.
Yeah, they had an endowment house separate from the temple so that they could do endowments in areas where they did not have a temple created.
Yeah, they had an endowment house in Salt Lake for many, many years prior to the Salt Lake Temple being finished.
That's correct.
But this is interesting because, I mean, I've studied so much church history. I really love the fact that I'm learning something I didn't know. So keep going, Melanie.
Okay. Well, that's all I have, actually, as far as my timeline. So after the 1946, you know, that ended it, and there wasn't the healings ended, and there haven't been any performed that have been authorized by the church since.
So, Melanie, could you tell us a little bit about how you got interested and involved in this?
Yes. Actually, how this came about for me was I was in graduate school, and I'm actually still in graduate school. But last year, in the fall, I took a women and religion course. My MFA program requires us to take these outside courses to foster our environmental emphasis for our degree. And I'd spent a lot of time in religion. And the women in religion topic appealed to me for reasons that I probably couldn't articulate at the time. And as I sat in the class, I learned so much about how patriarchy had influenced the society that we live in today. And at the end of the class, we were given the option of doing a large project on whatever we chose. And I, being a good Mormon woman, was most interested in writing about my own religion. So I wanted to do a book review, but it had to be an academic book. And so I looked for a Mormon feminist academic book. And there is only one in existence as far as I know. And if anyone knows of another, I'd be thrilled to hear of it. But the one that I found was Maxine Hank's book, Women in Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism. And in this book, I learned of all the information that I just gave to you, which I was completely, completely unaware of, and also learned of that women used to discuss having a Heavenly Mother and what that could potentially mean. It was a collection of essays by various intellectuals and feminists. And after reading that book, I felt wholeheartedly inspired, and I viewed not only myself, but my church in a completely different light. And I really felt like my soul had woken up after being asleep for 10 years. And I was so excited to share what I had learned and knew from reading Maxine Hank's book. I sat down to write my review. And I learned that Maxine Hanks had been excommunicated for writing it. And in that moment, my trust in church leadership just completely shattered because I couldn't understand how something that had inspired me so much could be wrong. So from that moment on, my life was different because I had to come to terms with what the church officially said and what I knew in my heart to be true. And just having so many spiritual experiences, throughout my life and feeling so close to that other power. You know, I couldn't deny that I had been given spiritual gifts that I felt like I wasn't able to use. And then I just had to decide from there, you know, what I was going to do with that new truth. You know, when you're faced with a great truth, you know, do you act or do you not act? And, you know, I'm the type of person that I've always been very genuine and heartfelt, and I can't tell a lie to save my life, and I can't walk the line of hypocrisy. And so even though it was very, very difficult, I decided that I was going to do something and speak up and want something for women that maybe they don't want for themselves, but I feel like it's worth working towards anyway.
Wow. So Melanie, I really appreciate you sharing that experience. I had a couple questions, and I'm sure George does too, but one of my questions is, you did not know that Maxine Hanks was excommunicated for that book prior to researching it, reading it?
No, not at all. I was completely unaware. And it wasn't until after I'd read the book that I found that out. I had some questions in my mind of how authorized the book would be, but by church standards, you know, I mean, I'm not stupid, but I didn't know anything about the September 6th. I didn't know that intellectuals were being excommunicated from the church. I had no idea. And then when I learned that, there was just a whole new reality for me.
What about this aspect? You say that you related to the topics and the things that were discussed in that book and that you connected on a deep level.
Yes.
Do you consider yourself a kind of form of a feminist prior to all this and even now?
That's a great question. I think I know that I was always a feminist, and that in order to keep myself safe, I had buried my feminism. That at my heart, I have always been a feminist. And I think what I believe happened to me is I believe I just became more face to face with who I truly was. And that part had always been in me. It was lying dormant, but I believe it was always there.
I'm paraphrasing a quote that I heard, and I'll probably butcher it, but it was a quote of about what feminism is that I heard this last year at Sunstone, and it was essentially the belief that a woman can do anything that she desires to do or become everything that she wants to become. And when I heard that, I had to kind of say to myself, well, I guess I'm a feminist as well. Melanie, what's your kind of your definition of, you know, quickly, what is a feminist when you say you're a feminist?
I embrace that definition. I think that feminism has kind of gotten this bad connotation associated with it. It's the F word, when it really doesn't deserve that. A lot of extreme feminists have given it kind of this association, I think. But feminism truly isn't shaving your head, although sometimes I find that tempting. But it isn't about that. It's more about wanting equality, valuing women in the same ways that we value men. And that isn't to say that men and women are not different, because they are. They definitely have different natural abilities. And I feel like those should be embraced and celebrated. I don't think we should, pretend that men and women are exactly the same. But I think as far as opportunity and freedom and expression, those should be equal for both sexes. And I, I believe that is what feminism is. And I believe men can be feminists as well as women, if, as long as they believe in those same values. Men can claim that title as well.
Thanks.
How about this, Melanie? Have you had the opportunity to reach out to Maxine Hanks at all and talk to her?
I have. I met with her at Sunstone. I went to the Twilight panel, which she was moderating. I wasn't very interested in Twilight, but I was definitely interested in meeting Maxine Hanks. So I sat through the panel, which was actually very fascinating. And after the panel, I went up to her and I said, your book changed my life and you're the reason I'm here. And we went to dinner together in the hotel, and we talked for 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
And she just kept asking me, you know, what do you want to write? And at that dinner, we conceived of this novel that I'm working on now. And she really, she honed me in. She helped me focus my energy. She gave me encouragement in the project that I didn't have before. I mean, that experience, that meeting just felt so faded to me. And so we're in contact now through email, and she's helping me through the drafting stage of the book, and she'll be helping me in the final stages as well, I'm sure. And she's going to sit in on it as an honorary member on my committee for the thesis project. So
that is so awesome. That is great.
Yeah. It is awesome.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know if you had a chance to hear from Maxine at all. You said you were surprised that she had been excommunicated. Is there a reason that she has stated or is kind of documented as to what she did in the process of that book that caused the excommunication process to occur?
Interesting. We didn't talk about that specifically. We did talk about the excommunication, but we talked about it on an emotional level because we're two women, probably. We talked about, how that made her feel. She seemed pretty over it. You know, it was, over, 15 years ago. So she did not seem like it bothered her or she had emotion behind it. She's kind of moved past the church. And I know she's a Gnostic now. I believe she's in some sort of leadership at the church she participates in. So she seems to be at a good, peaceful place, and seems to view that whole aspect of her life as maybe something that was maybe not pleasant but necessary. So
one of the things that you do in your paper is you refer to Maxine as a battering ram.
Oh, right.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that and what that means to you?
Well, I made a really good friend, Holly, who's in my ward, and we share a lot of feminist ideas. And when I was first going through this this process of understanding the real world, I guess is how I would put that, understanding the way things really are in terms of if you want to be a Mormon and a feminist, I went to her house and I said, "There's nothing we can do, Holly. There's nothing we can do. Look at Maxine Hanks. She was excommunicated. As soon as you speak out, your voice is going to be discredited." And she said, "Well, I think you should think of it maybe a little differently. Maxine Hanks is like a battering ram." So I don't mean to steal that. That actually started with Holly, but she called her a battering ram. She's like, if you look at the feminist pink, she does some really extreme things. But we need her. We need these crazy radical feminists because they make the rest of us, the more mainstream feminists, appear more normal and acceptable. So that's kind of what that's referring to, is we have these people doing the extreme and putting themselves on the front lines and getting excommunicated. But then that clears a path of sorts for the people who come after. So.
Hey, Melanie, can I ask you another question? I kind of want to go back to the women in the priesthood issue for a minute. I know, because this is kind of new to me. I remember when I had my crisis of faith, I remember someone asking me, well, don't you think that women have a form of priesthood? Because, I mean, I'm sure they don't let men in the washings and anointings inside the temple, so don't they do some sort of ordinance work or confirmations or anything like that? And I hadn't really thought about it. Obviously, I hadn't snuck in and taken a peek. And I was too embarrassed to really ask anybody that either. So what about where it's at, where the church is at with it today? I mean, they obviously still do that, right?
I think you're referring to the initiatory being performed in the temple. Is that what you're referring to?
That women still perform some sort of ordinance that might be related to the priesthood, right?
That's correct. Well, I would say that's somewhat correct. From what I understand, and I actually haven't done the research on this, from what I understand is women used to perform those ordinances in the temple by citing the Melchizedek priesthood, and now they don't. And I know for a fact that they don't now. The part about whether they once did, that's the part I'm not sure about. But when I was struggling, my bishop encouraged me to go to the temple and participate in an initiatory to help me deal with some of my feminist struggles. And one of the things that was glaringly obvious to me was when the woman performed the initiatory, she said, by authority, ellipses there of the performance, the script. And so they're acting under some authority, but it is an unnamed authority. So that leaves a lot of questions for me, I guess.
Yeah, because I don't know if you know the answer to this, but, I mean, do they actually get the laying on of hands for that authority, do you think? Or do you know?
I know that they lay their hands on your head, and they do it with authority.
The ones that are actually doing the ordinances themselves, do they get Melchizedek priesthood holders to lay their hands on them and set them apart?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that either.
I'm just guessing here. I don't know the answer to this, but I would imagine when you're set apart as an ordinance worker, you're set apart and given whatever rights and authority you need to do that. I don't know if the women would receive anything different if they're going to work initiatory or not. That's an excellent question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what about today, Melanie? What outside of the temple, are there other areas where women exercise the priesthood in this type of way today? And are you advocating for that? Or is it just kind of this temple experience only that's the only place that it's done?
As far as I know, that is the only place. I guess there is a couple of ways of approaching the entire issue of women laying out of hands, because they never, as far as I, from my perception, they never really did it with the priesthood. So there is the question of whether we could just restore sanctioning the practice without actually giving them priesthood authority. So there's that question. And then there's the question of just a full application of priesthood authority to women, including integrating them into leadership and possible general authority positions.
What about this, Melanie? I mean, if you could sit down with the general authority right now, I know that this is kind of maybe your tipping point, this whole issue, or partly related to your strugglings with the church. If you could sit down with the general authority right now and give him recommendations for the future of the church and how to handle women, what would you say?
I would definitely tell him that just because women aren't complaining that they don't have the priesthood, that doesn't mean that they don't want the priesthood. I really feel like women want so much to obey. You know, we're taught to have it's such a strong culture of obedience. And the minute you're not obeying, you're being seen as a sinner. So, it's not even within the realm of psychological possibility to think whether you should have the priesthood or not. It just wouldn't be acceptable. I think it can be really dismissive to just assume that because women aren't complaining about the priesthood, that they wouldn't necessarily love for the first presidency to come out and say, give women the priesthood.
I remember in the mid 80s, I was living in a young marriage ward in Provo, and this topic came up at that point because, of course, it was a young marriage, and so there was many, many births happening, and it got into the ward somehow that could the young mothers who were having their babies blessed by their husband join in the ordination circle during the name and the blessing. That went back and forth for 2 or 3 months, and the women, you know, trying to decide whether they wanted the priesthood or whether they just wanted to stand in the circle, or whether they could say amen, whether they could, and it was a big deal. And finally, the bishop said, "Hey, I think it's going to be great. Come on up and start doing it." And I think it happened one fast Sunday, and then somebody got word of it, and it got squashed pretty quick. But I remember at that point the discussion was fairly open, and women were being able to allowed to say and to think in the way that you're saying that they generally don't, because I agree in general they don't. But in this case, that they were able to actually think about it and think about what it would mean as a change in their lives, just for that simple thing of being able to walk up and join in the circle when their child receives a name and a blessing.
Mm-hmm. I think it can be really useful to look at the progress that we've made and think in terms of not wanting to go back. For example, it's a bad thing that there's so much divorce going on in the world today, but we don't really want to go back to the time when we couldn't get divorce. Likewise, we appreciate that we have blacks that are able to hold the priesthood today, but we don't want to go back to a time when they couldn't do that, right? We don't want to go backwards. so even though wanting women to have the priesthood seems really wrong at the moment, if you think in terms of looking backwards, it might be viewed in the same way the black priesthood issue is viewed.
So you do think that the church has actually made some pretty big steps forward? Like, I remember, was it in the 70s with the ERA movement? When I think I believe it was the church that said, they were trying to, stop the ERA vote. Are you very familiar with that, Melanie?
I am very familiar. I read, Sonia Johnson's, autobiographical account of that story. She was the woman who was excommunicated for representing the ERA.
Oh.
The ERA did not pass, and the church was heavily involved, much like they are involved with Prop 8 in terms of working actively against it.
So do you see, I mean, it's kind of easy to compare, you know, the blacks and the priesthood and the ban that they endured, women in the priesthood, and some of the equal right issues that women have endured. And now you can even throw in homosexuals and the kind of discrimination that they endure inside the church. Do you foresee a day when women will actually feel equal to men inside the church? Or
for me personally, I have to see that, or I wouldn't be able to stay. I understand that's a really tough road. And that there's a lot of people and a lot of smart, intelligent people who have made the argument that it won't happen. And I understand that some are saying that. But I personally believe that we will see the day when women will have the priesthood granted them.
So Melanie, what do you think about when you then hear statements that, like, President Hinckley gave on CNN, where he talks about how happy the women in the church are that they have their own organization, 4 million plus members, doesn't know of another women's organization in the world which does so much for women, mm-hmm. and that they're happy. and he doesn't hear any complaints about it. What do those kind of statements do for women? Or
okay, well, there's two parts to that. One is the idea that the Relief Society is this powerful organization. My response to that is that it used to be. It used to be a very powerful organization. The women ran it themselves. They had their own budgets. They made their own administrative choices. And it was very independent. It was connected, directly connected to the church, but it was run independently of it. And that has been changed. Now it is all very much subordinate to the brethren. So that's one thing. The other thing that you said was that it, Gordon B. Hinckley didn't hear anyone complaining. That was a very interesting quote for me. When I read this at Sunstone, a few older ladies in the audience laughed out loud at that quote. And one of the ladies said, "We have been complaining." And my heart kind of broke for her, because I can imagine that she's probably been in this position since the 70s. How do I interpret that? The only way I can interpret that is Gordon B. Hinckley didn't want to believe that women, so he was like just putting on his blinders, or that he chose not to acknowledge those women who might complain. He somehow is making that viewpoint illegitimate by saying that they don't even exist. So that's strong language, I felt. And considering that he was pretty heavily involved in the ERA fiasco, I would call it a fiasco, I would say that that's probably an incorrect statement for him to make. He was aware of some people, you know, complaining. He said he didn't personally hear it, and I think I could see that, because he's probably surrounded by a lot of Orthodox women. But that doesn't mean that there aren't women out there who are complaining, or that the women around him wouldn't want it if they were actually offered it.
Or women just don't feel like they have the right to complain, right?
Right.
Here's another question for you. In your studies and your research, working with Maxine Hanks, did you ever draw parallels to the former RLDS Church, which is the Community of Christ Church? Because if I'm correct, somewhere in the 80s, they allowed women into their leadership,
I'm aware of that. I want to say it was the 70s. I don't have an exact date. Pretty sure it was earlier than the 80s.
Okay.
And what happened was they had a portion in Max Exodus. I want to say it was somewhere between, I think it was 20%. And so this is an argument that's been raised a lot, that because there was kind of this portion of people that just up and left because they were so outraged that women got the priesthood, that maybe a similar thing would happen in the LDS church if that were to happen. I feel like the culture that we live in 2009 is drastically different than the culture that we had in the 70s. Feminism was just beginning to bud. It was a very new, very edgy concept, whereas now it's pretty much standard and accepted, particularly outside the church. And I really have a difficult time imagining people being upset because women are allowed to hold the priesthood. I really have a difficult time envisioning that.
So you don't think that there would be a mass exodus in the LDS church if they allowed it nowadays?
I personally can't visualize it. If it was condoned by the leadership, I think it would be embraced.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. You know what I find interesting about the Mormon religion is? The fact that it has a mother in heaven persona that's kind of in the shadows. It could be such a good religion that would embrace feminism and women. Mm-hmm. I would think it has the potential for. I mean, I remember reading a lot of Margaret Toscano stuff. She loved the whole idea with Mother in Heaven, and that was kind of her crux that cost her membership.
Right, right. Yeah, that was And that was heavily in that book that I read, was talking about that issue. And what's so neat about the Mormon Church is that it does evolve. That's what's so exciting about it. It's a church that evolves. So then there's like all this excitement that there's all these possibilities of changes that could happen. And I think one of the things that emerged, like you said, was the Mother in Heaven concept, which is really foreign to other types of Christianity.
Yep.
When I wrote my paper, my instructor was like, well, this is a nice thought, but it's not Christian. That's just so exciting, like you said. And that was one of the things that kind of woke me up, I would say, was reading about that and thinking about a mother in heaven that's like the equivalent to the dad. I have a mom and a dad. Like, that was so amazing and so affirming for a female to think about that, you know, to think about your body, your female body being like deity. I mean, that's something that men take for granted. But for a woman, that's really empowering to think of that.
I think the church struggles with whether they want to be totally unique or very much like everybody else. Because every time it seems like they go down a very unique set of doctrines, which having a mother in heaven would definitely be, you know, a long ways away from the rest of Christianity. They attract a group, and then they find out over time that it kind of shoots them in the foot. And I think President Hinckley tried to pull us back over to the more the mainstream way, but I think they lost some people because of it, possibly.
Yeah, he was the one that put the gag order on the Mother in Heaven. It was him.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, it was a final word by Gordon B. Hinckley saying not to pray to her. And that upset a lot of women because they were excited about that. And I know some feminists actually indoctrinate their children to pray to Mother and Father in heaven. I don't pray to Mother in heaven. And I think it's just because it's so instilled in me to pray to my Father in heaven. I don't know. I think of my Mother in heaven sometimes when I pray. But it just feels weird.
That's cool. Melanie, thanks so much for a great summary of where the kind of the church has gone over the past and what some potentials are for going into the future. I just wanted to give you kind of an opportunity to leave us with some parting thoughts, and then we'll call it good.
One thing that might be good is to read from my post my main issues with women in the priesthood. Some women have the gift to heal, but our God-given talents are not given any form of outlet in the church whatsoever. To me, this goes against God. He doesn't endow us with gifts or talents without expecting us to use them. I have heard no coherent or reasonable explanation as to why women do not have the priesthood. I've heard that women are different from men and have a different purpose. True, but if that different purpose includes not having the priesthood, why did God endow them with spiritual gifts? That just doesn't make sense to me. I've also heard that men has the priesthood, women has motherhood explanation. This concept basically equates the power to have a child as an endowment from God equal to the male priesthood. I have one problem with this. Any man who lives worthily has access to his priesthood ordinance. A woman can live worthily and still not be able to produce a child. Would that be fair? Would a fair and just God do such a thing? I've also heard that the wife shares the priesthood with her husband equally. I've never understood that logic. A woman can call upon her husband to give a blessing, but so can anyone else who needs a blessing from him. Logistically speaking, I don't understand in what way a woman shares that privilege. I also believe strongly that in the church should not dictate the role of mother or homemaker to women. That's not to say that I don't value that profession, because I do. But I also happen to believe that women will choose that profession without having it dictated or giving some sort of God sanction for that profession. I think that when the church does that, it pits the women who stay home against the women who work within the church, and creates tension there. It creates guilt and unrest in the women who are working, who really don't have a choice. And that's really what it boils down to for me is choice. Men aren't told what profession they should have in their lives, and I don't believe women should be told either. I don't think we'll have a shortage of stay-at-home moms if the church stops telling women to stay home. I don't believe that. I believe I would have still chosen the path I chose, where I spent a lot of my time in school because and working a small part-time job in order to be home. And I think I still would have had those values, even if the church wasn't imposing those on me. I still believe in putting family first above all else. Putting your children is your number one priority. But I think it should be between the husband and wife how they choose to do that. And there shouldn't be a shaming of people who have to do non-traditional types of caring for a family. So I'll just leave with that.
Thank you, Melanie. For me, I just wanted to say how much I appreciate you willing to share your thoughts, your experience, your research with us. I learned a lot, and my heart goes out to you and really all women, like my wife. You know, this is a big issue inside for women inside the church. It's not something that should be taken lightly, and I do hope and pray that someday that women will eventually be completely treated as equals, because I do think they deserve that.
Thank you. I hope for that too.
I definitely want to echo those sentiments as well. This was an opportunity and a wonderful chance for every woman in the church to kind of expand and wonder what the possibilities and what it would look like if something were to occur in that vein. And Melanie, I think you do a wonderful job of articulating what the past is and what some of the things are and some of the opportunities for the future. So thank you very, very much for coming on with us tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. It was great.
I'd like to thank Melanie Cowley for coming on the podcast and sharing this great information and for having the courage to do so. Also, thanks to George and Tom for conducting a great interview. You can find a copy of Melanie's Sunstone presentation at the Sunstone website. She also has a great short story out there called Broken Shoulders that can be found at thepaperbagwriter.org if you want to search for her name at that website. I will also post a link to it up on the website. Remember that the discussion continues at mormonexpression.com. Check out the blog there for information on this and other podcasts. You can also call and leave a message at 801-906-6722. You can also email us at mail@mormonexpression.com.